By the time a dirty dawnlight began to creep through the overhanging trees, gnarled, moss-hung monstrosities of a sort Tim had never seen before, his tussock was surrounded by 24 of the circling shapes. The shortest looked to be about 10 feet in length, but most were far longer. Shouting and clapping no longer drove them away. They were going to come for him. If that wasn't bad enough, there was now enough light coming through the green roof for him to see that his death and ingestion would have an audience. It wasn't yet bright enough for him to make out the faces of the watchers, and for this Tim was miserably glad. Their slumped, semi-human shapes were bad enough. They stood on the nearest bank, 70 or 80 yards away. He could make out 6, but thought there were more. The dim and misty light made it hard to tell for sure. Their shoulders were rounded, their shaggy heads thrust forward. The tatters hanging from their indistinct bodies might have been the remnants of clothing or ribbons of moss like those hanging from the branches. To Tim, they looked like a small tribe of mudmen who had risen from the watery floor of the swamp just to watch the swimmers first tease and then take their prey. What does it matter? I'm a goner whether they watch or not. One of the circling reptiles broke from the pack and drove at the tussock, tail lashing the water, prehistoric head raised, jaws split in a grin that looked longer than Tim's whole body. It struck below the place where Tim stood, and hard enough to make the tussock shiver like jelly. On the bank, several of the watching mudmen hooted. Tim thought they were like spectators at a Saturday afternoon points match. The idea was so infuriating that it drove his fear out. What rushed in to fill the place where it had been was fury. Would the water beasts have him? He saw no way they would not. Yet if the foreshot the widow had given him hadn't taken too much of a wetting, he might be able to make at least one of them pay for its breakfast. And if it doesn't fire, I'll turn it around and club the beast with the butt end until it tears my arm off my shoulder. The thing was crawling out of the water now, the claws at the end of its stubby front legs tearing away clumps of reed and weed, leaving black gashes that quickly filled up with water. Its tail, blackish green on top, white as a dead man's belly beneath, drove it ever forward and upward, slapping at the water and throwing fans of muddy filth in all directions. Above its snout was a nest of eyes that pulsed and bulged. They never left Tim's face. The long jaws gnashed. The teeth sounded like stones driven together. On the shore, 70 yards or 1,000 wheels, it made no difference. The mudmen called again, seeming to cheer the monster on. Tim opened the cotton sack. His hands were steady and his fingers sure, although the thing had hauled 6 its length onto the little island, and there was now only 3 feet between Tim's sodden boots and those clicking teeth. He pulled back one of the hammers, as the widow had shown him, curled his finger around the trigger, and dropped to one knee. Now he and the approaching horror were on the same level. Tim could smell its rich carrion breath and see deep into its pulsing pink gullet. Yet Tim was smiling. He felt it stretching his lips, and he was glad. It was good to smile in one's final moments, so it was. He only wished it was the barony tax collector crawling up the bank with his treacherous green familiar on his shoulder. "Let's see how he liked this, Cully," Tim murmured, and pulled the trigger. There was such a huge bang that Tim at first believed the foreshot had exploded in his hand. Yet it wasn't the gun that exploded, but the reptile's hideous nest of eyes. They splattered blackish-red ichor. The creature uttered an agonized roar and curled backward on its tail. Its short forelegs pawed the air. It fell into the water, thrashed, then rolled over, displaying its belly. A red cloud began to grow around its partially submerged head. Its hungry ancient grin had become a death rictus. In the trees, rudely awakened birds flapped and chattered and screamed down abuse. Still wrapped in that coldness, and still smiling, although he wasn't aware of it, Tim broke open the foreshot and removed the spent casing. It was smoking and warm to the touch. He grabbed the half loaf, stuck the bread plug in his mouth, and thumbed one of the spare loads into the empty chamber. He snapped the pistol closed and spat out the plug, which now had an oily taste. "Come on!" he shouted to the reptiles that were now swimming back and forth in agitated fashion. The hump marking the top of the submerged dragon had disappeared. "Come have some more!" Nor was this bravado. Tim discovered he actually wanted them to come. Nothing, not even his father's axe, which he still carried in his belt, had ever felt so divinely right to him as did the heavy weight of the foreshot in his left hand. From the shore came a sound Tim could not at first identify, not because it was strange, but because it ran counter to all the assumptions he had made about those watching. The mudmen were clapping. When he turned to face them, the smoking gun still in his hand, they dropped to their knees, fisted their foreheads, and spoke the only word of which they seemed capable. That word was Heil, one of the few which is exactly the same in both low and high speech, the one the Manny called Fin Gann, or the first word, the one that set the world spinning. "Is it possible?" Tim Ross, son of Jack, looked from the kneeling mudmen on the bank to the antique but very effective weapon he still held. "Is it possible they think?" It was possible. More than possible, in fact. These people of the Fagonard believed he was a gunslinger.